Today FM's Dermot and Dave.
Since yesterday, the entire country has been in level 5 lockdown with the aim to suppress the virus and have ourselves a good Christmas. Chief Medical Officer Dr. Tony Holohan joins us now this morning.
Hi, Dr. Holohan, how are you?
Tony, Dermot, how are you doing?
Okay, Tony, nice to talk to you. I'm well, thanks. A couple of days in, how are you feeling about level 5 lockdown now?
Well, it's a big challenge for all of us. It's a set of very significant measures that the government has decided to implement. And for the next 6 weeks, each one of us is going to have to play our part, taking our own individual responsibility to look after the things that we can individually influence. And if each one of us does that, then we have a chance of making this work in the time frame that we've set out. We have a large volume of disease in the country, and we know, I'm sure everybody's heard, the number of cases increasing, the number of hospitalizations increasing, and unfortunately some of the deaths now beginning to increase. We have to overcome this challenge because it represents a risk not only to the health of people, but it's a risk to things that are important to us as a society. We need to keep education going. We need to keep our childcare going. We need to keep our health service going for people who need it for all sorts of other health issues other than just COVID. And obviously we need to protect the people who are most vulnerable to the severe impacts of this disease. But if we pull together with all of these measures, and each one of us takes our individual responsibility for the things that we can change in our own lives, then I'm confident we can pull together as we did in the spring and get this back down to levels of control that we can manage by the beginning of December.
Given the way everything went, I was even looking at a graph today that showed us the overall cases in Ireland of the cases of all time, and there was the spike and then it went down and then it's gone back up now and it's even gone higher. Is it inevitable that was going to happen?
Well, there's nothing inevitable about it, but it to keep a virus like this suppressed to the low levels we saw in the spring or in the summertime, I should say, it was always going to be a very big challenge. I mean, if you look across Europe now, we're about mid-table in terms of where every other country in Europe is, all experiencing significant growth in the level of infection. So really the whole of Europe is experiencing a second wave or a second surge. There's nothing inevitable about the fact that we passed this infection from one to the other. But it was always going to be a challenge for us to keep it down at those kind of low levels of transmission. And the key thing for us now is to get it back down to those low levels and then do everything we can in our collective behaviour as a society to try and keep it down there. This reproductive number that we use is kind of a mathematical concept that kind of measures how easily this virus is transmitting through the population at any point in time. If we left this virus to its own devices and didn't change our behaviour at all, the reproductive number we know would be between 4 and 5, perhaps even a bit higher. What we've experienced in this country over the last number of months, it's been somewhere between 1.2 and 1.4. What that tells us is that there's really a lot of good behavior, a lot of people complying with the public health advice to keep the virus suppressed to that level of a reproductive number. And still, we've seen the substantial growth in cases that has occurred, because anything above one, a reproductive number above one, means that we're growing the amount of disease in the population at any point in time. And we're now growing unsustainable levels and from a very high level. And we need to break that. And the way we break that is by coming together and driving that reproductive number as low as we got it, if we can, in the springtime, which was, we think, in the region of about 0.5. And what really means is that, on average, for each 2 people who have the disease, only 1 more person becomes infected. And that means the disease is on an extinguishing pathway, if you like. Mm. So that's the concept of reproductive number.
One of the things that people are struggling with is wondering whether any of this will have any real effect. Do you think 6 weeks of level 5 is actually going to do the job?
We think we have a chance. We think if we get the reproductive number to that level from where we are at the moment, it will get us back down to levels that we can manage with. And the further down we go, the longer the benefit we're going to get from this. And if we can get it as low as possible, that's what we're aiming to do. If we don't get it down to, you know, if let's just say we got it down to say something like 500 cases a day from where we are now, which is about 1200 cases a day, that would seem like a lot of improvement, but quite quickly, if we lift the restrictions, it could grow again from that level and cause us to be back in this kind of situation very, very quickly. But if we drive it down to a level, for example, below 100 or something of that order, it would take a good deal longer than that to cause the kind of challenge that we're seeing at the moment.
Do you think we should prepare ourselves for this cycle that until a vaccine comes along, we're going to have periods of on and off, periods of lockdown and periods of a less, you know, a lower level, but that we will probably have to go back to a level, a higher level, repeatedly until the vaccine is developed and available?
There's no question that the level of restrictions that are in place that we've asked people to now live with are very, very onerous. We really don't want to be living with those kinds of restrictions for any longer than we need to. And what we know and we're learning for the future is that if we apply them when the disease is at this kind of level, we can get the disease back in control. And if we can maintain a good standard of behaviour in terms of compliance with the public health advice, then we can push out into the future further the likelihood of a further surge. And if we see that happening and take action on that earlier, we can minimise the impact of this into the future without the need for us to have recourse to very substantial repeated restrictions. And obviously, we're looking at the possibility of vaccine coming. It's not a certainty, but we're increasingly getting optimistic because there are many, many different companies involved in the production of vaccines. So we're hopeful, but we can't plan on the basis of certainty as yet. So we have to consider all these different scenarios in terms of our long-term planning. But the basic message for your listeners is that to the extent that we can influence this individually, we all need to get together now and focus on the actions that we can take. I have a particular message for people who are cases, and a particular message for people who are close contacts of those cases, because these are the people right now who are most important in the population in terms of our behaviours. So if you're a person, and we know that young people, particularly people between the ages of 19 and 24, they have the highest incidence in the population at the moment. But if you're a case, or if you've been tested and you're waiting for results, or if you're waiting for a test and it hasn't been arranged yet, or perhaps you have symptoms and you're worried and you haven't yet gotten to arrange for a test, in any of those situations, you must self-isolate. You must self-isolate. And what that means is not just staying at home, not just not going to work, it means staying in your room and making arrangements in your household and with your family to not share common spaces, to not share the bathroom, to not share utensils and so on. That's a real challenge, but it's really important because that's the first way that you stop this infection passing in your own household from you to other people. So self-isolation is not just staying at home, it's staying in your room. It's only staying at home if you live on your own. And then the next group of people are the people who live in the house. In other words, close household contacts. If you live with somebody who is in that category of either having tested positive or having symptoms, then if that person is self-isolating, you are then regarded as a close contact if you live with them. If you're a close contact, that means you must restrict your movement for 14 days. And restricting movement means not going to work and not going to school. And if we get people who are cases or who have symptoms consistent with COVID, self-isolating, and if we get the people who live with them, who are close contacts, restricting their movements and not going to work and school, we really have a significant chance of achieving this. So the government has done, if you like, its bit. It's made big, big decisions, difficult decisions that we all have to shoulder. But each one of us then as an individual have to focus on what our behaviours will be. The important behaviours for us right now are the behaviours of those people who are either cases or potential cases, and then those who are living with those as close contacts. That's a really important message for everybody to get across, right across the population.
It's been reported that the mortality rate amongst younger people is lower, but there's been stories of young people who have been left with long-term health implications. What kind of cases are doctors encountering?
Yeah, you're right that like one of the things we're increasingly learning about this disease, that it does have the potential to have, for a small number of people, long-term health consequences that people will live with rather than, you know, other types of like, so influenza and other infections we might have seen before, we might not have seen the same pattern. And so increasingly we're beginning to understand that there are long-term consequences for some people. And the international community, if you like, from a medical point of view, is studying that, trying to look at what are the risk factors for that? Are there ways in which we can reduce the risk factors for individuals who pick up this infection to prevent that from happening to them? And then what would be the long-term prognosis or consequences for those individuals? We've seen inflammatory conditions in young children and young adults. They're not common, but they do occur. And that can lead to damage to a number of different organ systems. We've seen people having a thing we call cardiomyopathy, which is damage to the muscle of the heart that can be caused in small numbers of people. But it happens, and it's something, if you like, relatively unusual. And it has been picked up internationally, and it's giving concern. And it's one of the things that we have to factor in terms of, you know, the importance of preventing the transmission of this infection. There are many people, and you've heard it, I'm sure, advocating a strategy whereby we, as it were, let it rip, let this infection do its thing. The majority of people don't have, much to worry about from this infection. And we know that that's not true. But the risk for most people is low, particularly if you're younger and you don't have underlying conditions. But those risks are there at every age. And then the really critical thing for people and for those of us who are young is that even if this disease is not a significant risk to my health, as a young person, I could pick this up and bring it home. And somebody I live with, an older person or somebody who has an underlying medical condition, this is a very, very different scenario. When I say that, if you don't mind me just making this additional point, it's really important that we all take responsibility for the measures we can take, but ultimately remember that this is a highly infectious respiratory viral infection. It's about twice as easy to transmit this as it is to transmit flu. So even though we can say we're each responsible for the actions we take, we shouldn't blame each other for the fact that we become infected. So if you, as a young person, bring this infection home, and you've infected somebody else in the household, it's not your fault. And you can accept responsibility for your behaviours and do your best to try to manage yourself and to minimise the risk of becoming infected. But if you pick up this infection, you bring this infection home and it infects other people, it isn't your fault. We need to move away from this kind of culture of blame that has become, I think, established around the transmission of this virus. Whose fault is it that I became infected? Is it my fault that I infected somebody else? So responsibility is important, but we need to avoid blame.
Speaking of young people, we've a lot of parents listen to the show, and they were in touch during the week, and some of them are scared to send their kids to school. Others are angry that their child, you know, can't go on a play date but can spend the day in a classroom with all the other children. What would you say to parents who are listening right now who are feeling a gamut of emotions?
Well, maybe two things I'd say in response to that. So first of all, we've been looking very closely at the data in relation to the risks of infection, the rate of infection among school children. And we see it's much lower than we might expect for the percentage of the population that they represent. That, what that tells us is that attendance at school isn't increasing the transmission on the basis of the data we're seeing for children. And that's consistent with what the international picture is saying. So that's the first thing. The second thing to say is that we have decided rightly as a country that educating children at primary and secondary stage and maintaining that program of education in our schools, as well as early childcare and childcare services, these are really critically important services that we want to maintain and we want to protect. We didn't maintain them during the first wave back in the springtime. Many children missed out on quite extended periods of education. We know the long-term consequences of that for children, and we have rightly decided that this is something we really need to protect and preserve. And so everything we're doing here in terms of the measures that government has decided upon is with the aim of protecting early child care, protecting education, as well as other vital services, as I've already mentioned, in healthcare, and protecting vulnerable and those at risk for picking up the infection.
What about gyms? There's been a lot of talk about them. I suppose we're heading into shorter evenings, you know, darker evenings, and the impact on mental health where people can't get that physical exercise, that mental release that thing places like gyms and other sporting clubs offer. Is there any leniency for keeping some of those open?
So we think that we need to, for a period, a short period, and it's a very hard measure for us to be talking about when you talk about gyms. Look, we think we need to be stopping many of the kinds of activities that we think are discretionary. And what I mean is that there are some interactions that that we think are important to maintain, because we want to maintain services. We want to keep education going. We want to keep health services going. And if we want to do that with the disease transmission at the level that it's at the moment, we really have to stop every possible social interaction, particularly those that happen indoors, as much as we possibly can. That's the reason we focus now only on essential retail, essential work, essential services. So the basic message now for everybody is to stay at home unless your activity, either going to work or school, is essential, or you're going within 5 kilometres of your own home for outdoor exercise. That's, in a sense, that's a kind of a short version of the core of the decision that the government has made, the ask that's been made of each one of us as a society. And I understand the challenge that represents for many, many parts of our economy and society. It's not a value judgment on them, that we don't value them as core parts of what we want to have within our society. But it's a measure of what we now need to do to knuckle down, to do everything we possibly can to reduce the amount of interaction between people.
It's probably very difficult when you're in the middle of everything to project into the future. But do you think there might be some long-term good to come out of this, in the sense that the entire population has been made aware of the necessity for a strong and fit-for-purpose health service, but also where we're at in relation to that, that we are struggling, and that the number of ICU beds is the lowest in OECD countries. And, you know, is there a chance that this, in decades to come, will see us with a better, stronger healthcare system that will be able to cope with these kinds of things should they come back around again?
Yeah, again, I might make 2 points in response to that question. The first is that I think in time we'll come to understand that, you know, this has been a really difficult period for us as a country. It's been a really difficult period for us as a species, almost mankind, and at a global level, and that it will have a lot of, as it were, negative, challenging consequences. But that we will learn things, and we will adapt, and we'll develop new capacities that we never had before. I'm doing an interview for you on Zoom right now. Video conferencing technology has become it's changed the way we interact with each other. Mm. I don't think those things will be lost. We will have new ways of connecting and learn new ways of connecting as people. I'm just choosing that as one simple random example. We've seen so many actions of solidarity and kindness and all of that across our population that this has woken us up to. So there will be benefit. There will be benefit that will last with us into the future, quite beyond the COVID itself. On the question of the health service, you're right, the health service is at the forefront of the challenge of responding to this disease. But if I might just describe the our defences against this in layers, our first layer of defence against this infection is the behaviour of each one of us as individuals in society, following the public health advice, social distancing, using face masks when in indoor settings, not going out and about when you have symptoms, staying at home and self-isolating, calling our GP, and all of that. We're all familiar with that advice. We all know what it is and what it means. Following that, that's the first line of defence. The next line of defence is that we have a really strong, fast public health system that's capable of identifying, testing, contact tracing, and then isolating individuals, controlling at a local level the spread of infection through identification of outbreaks and managing of those outbreaks and so on. The capacity of our system to do that when the infection is at the level it's at the moment is seriously challenged, but that's our second line of defence. If the next line of defence then is the health service, our GPs in the forefront, our accident and emergency services, and ultimately hospital beds, and for those small number of people who need them, intensive care beds. But the point I'd make to you is we can prevent a lot of that. It isn't a measure of success in the control of this disease that we have ICU beds to put them in. The measure of control of this disease is that we stop people requiring admission to intensive care in the first instance. And that's the obligation we have to protect public health. And when we think about ICU beds right at the moment, our hospital services are doing a really great job in dealing with all of the other challenges that our population experiences, from chronic diseases and severe and acute and emergencies of one kind or another. That's what our hospital beds are focused on at the moment. It's what our GPs are focused on at the moment. It's what our ICU beds are focused on at the moment. If we let this infection get too far ahead, it pushes out that kind of activity. Our ICU bed won't be available now for a person after a serious operation, a person after a road traffic accident, a person after a heart attack or some other condition. And that's what we want to prevent that. So it's not a measure of success for us to say, if we had 1,000 ICU beds, for example, we'd have enough room to put 500 people with COVID into ICU beds. It is not a good thing in the first instance to end up in ICU as a result of COVID. That has to be our approach.
But doesn't our level 5 restrictions, don't our restrictions, aren't they on paper more severe than our European neighbours because we're trying to protect and cradle our health service that was already straining at the seams before the pandemic even began?
I can tell you that many, many European countries are in much worse positions right now in terms of ICU capacity, who are seeking to buy ICU capacity from other European countries. There are desperate measures been taken by European capitals in Paris, in the Netherlands, and in many other countries to try to secure additional ICU capacity because of the challenges those countries are facing right now. The measures that are in place in many other European countries are, there's a different blend of measures, but you can see a pattern right across Europe of measures getting stronger and stricter and removing, if you like, the discretion for people in terms of their everyday. We've seen curfews introduced in many European countries in specific cities. And we've seen bars, restaurants, and a range of other public health measures akin to our own been taken in many of the European countries. But quite a few countries now experiencing a stress and an impact on their hospital and ICU capacity that's at a much more advanced stage than what we've so far experienced.
A personal question a little bit, Tony, but like you've had the kind of the fate of the nation sitting on your shoulders for the past 7 months, and we've all turned on the television and watched the press conferences, and whether it's yourself or Dr. Ronan Glynn, how does it feel? How are you on a day-to-day basis coping with that level of stress and pressure?
Look, it's a stress and pressure for every single one of us, whatever our roles are in society. I don't think it's anything like the stress and pressure for a person who finds themselves out of a job, self-isolating and having to live at home, and the mental health and isolation challenge that represents. From our point of view here, these are the jobs we were trained to do, and having the opportunity to do them and do them to the best of our ability. We're lucky to be in a position to be able to do that we're in a position to be able to come to work and to do a job that we think can make a difference to this. We're trained for it, and so it's all part and parcel of the work we do.
When things come back to normal, if they ever do, what would you be looking forward to doing most?
Personally?
Yeah.
Well, I like so many people in this country, like simple things. I'm heavily involved in the GAA at a local level and love to be able to go to a match and have a chat with somebody about a match and have a pint and, you know, not do much more than that, spend time with my family. These are the basic aspirations that we all have. And I think we've all learned, including myself, to value them just a little bit more than we might have in the past, and to realise how much of a privilege they are when we see the emergence of a virus that nature, in a way, has thrown up, threatening the very fabric of our being as humans, and taking away from us the kinds of things that the ordinary things we do in everyday life and that we love.
Dr. Tony Holohan, Chief Medical Officer, thanks so much for chatting to us this morning.
Thanks, Dermot. Thanks, Dave. Thanks very much indeed.
Dermot and Dave. Dermot and Dave. Listen live, on air, from 9 a.m. weekdays on Today FM.